Hello again, my friends, and welcome back here to Expanded Perspectives. Thank you so much for joining us, and I got a lot of feedback from the last show.
I told you, don't change it.
No, you told me before we went on air. I did it anyway, folks. Before you'll kind of get the groove of what I'm talking about, I'm Cam Hale, and joining me, as always, is Mr. Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody?
Yeah, everybody, they want to make sure we give out our names and the whole thing. I'm going to say it. I guess I'll just keep doing it. Doesn't matter what I like. It's what everybody else likes to hear. It's the groove. So it's going to be pretty much the same thing. Thank you for joining us here on another episode. And then our names, and we're just going to move on from there. That's what we're going to do. And we tried something else this weekend, folks. And for some of y'all that joined us, thank you so much.
The first time.
For the first time ever, yeah. Now, of course, we don't have any affiliation with this. We're not getting paid for this. It is just a fun thing. For those of you that use Twitter, and I guess I'm assuming you could do it without Twitter. Twitter just kind of links to it where you can find people with it.
I guess so. I know that Twitter is responsible for the app.
For the app. But the app we're speaking of is called Periscope. What it does is it allows for a lifetime video stream, and it's free. So, you know, if you were doing something and was just talking and everything, so when Kyle and I did it where we were in studio, you can pull it up and we're in there live, and people can follow us live. You can go back. It's archived. You can watch it. So when him and I are out doing things or doing other stuff in the studio, we're going to actually be doing a little filming and live streaming through that.
It's pretty cool. It is really cool. It's real. Yeah. I mean, technology surprises me every day. It's really neat. You can live stream. Anybody can do this. It's absolutely free. The app's free. You can live stream anything you're doing. Yeah. Now, what's cool is you can also follow other people. So like yesterday, I was just, you know, we went to putt-putt golfing games with the kids, and I was, you know, sitting down taking a break while they were riding rides and stuff. And just sitting there during the course of maybe 30 minutes, I had probably 10 people I saw that were periscoping. Mm-hmm. So one of them was like Joe Rogan. One of them was another guy. And so I could get to see what they're doing.
Yeah.
And like yesterday afternoon, there was three or four people that were periscoping what's the horse race? The Belmont yesterday. And so it was pretty cool because I could watch somebody's point of view of the actual race who was there.
That's pretty cool.
And not just a video, like, I mean, as it was happening.
Yeah. Now, this app is still in its infancy, folks.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there's not a lot of people using it. It's only been around, I think, maybe 60 days.
It's pretty cool.
It hasn't been. This is what I thought, too. And there's a lot of people that are just like, well, I don't care about seeing what some of those people are doing. And me and Kyle were talking off air, and I thought about this. For a lot of folks whose grandparents, you know, or say your mom and dad can't make it, and you have a son or a daughter that's in a dance recital or playing baseball or soccer.
Lots of people live in a different state.
Exactly. You could literally pull out your iPad, pull out your smartphone, whatever you got, and Periscope your son or daughter, what they were doing live, and your folks could watch it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could close it out where it could only be family that watched it, and your folks could watch it. You know, the grandparents could watch the grandchildren do those things if they couldn't make it. Or say a mom or dad has to work, and while they're at work, they're like, I can't be there. Like, well, Periscope me doing it. Well, boom, there it is. There's your daughter doing her thing, you know, up there dancing. On. So it really is something that we're going to be able to use. And also, too, I think about all this, the things that were going on, and there's crime in the streets and people video it and take pictures. Well, now you can video it in live time and archive it. So now, I mean, people, it's things, this is just more of that technology that's building and growing and all that. But anyway, to get away from that, we're going to be using it. So if you want to start watching us, we're going to be, when we go to different lectures, we have people in studio like we had Nick. We weren't periscoping, but when we will, we have more people in, we'll be periscoping.
I think it's pretty cool.
I think
because
it's
if you follow the
awesome.
Show, you can watch what we're periscoping, and then likewise, I can watch what you're
exactly.
what you're doing.
Exactly. I can see what y'all are up to. We can see what all the listeners are doing whenever they're out doing cool stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I had a listener yesterday who was just periscoping him grilling steaks on the grill. And I literally just watched him for like 5 minutes. And he was like, hey, he could see when I joined. So he was like, hey, Kyle, what's going on? I'm like,
and you can also talk. You can do chat. You know, you can hit the chat and it comes up on the screen while one of us is filming. We'll see what y'all are saying as it comes up in front of us. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Well, moving on to the news. Did you see this, Cam? The world's largest telescope begins construction.
Now, you and I were just, what's funny, that's a little synchronicity. We were just talking about that like 2 or 3 days ago.
Well, now I want a telescope even more.
Oh, great. Here we go. All right. What do you got?
It talks about after nearly a decade of planning, the construction of the Giant Magellan Telescope, or GMT, is finally underway. Now, this thing...
Wait.
What's one?
The Giant Magellan Telescope. That's what they came up. They didn't have a cooler name, and then they just call it the GMT.
That's it, baby. The GMT.
Okay.
Now, this thing is perched in the high mountains of northern Chile, and its primary optics consist of 7 27-foot diameter mirrors. So this thing is ginormous, which will proudly claim the title of the largest optical telescope ever built. Now, its mirrors will be capable of focusing more than 6 times the amount of light of the largest optical telescopes that we use today into images 10 times sharper than those that are even captured by the Hubble telescope.
Ooh.
So now a guy named Patrick McCarthy, who's the director for the GMT, says that every time someone builds a new telescope, we learn something new about the universe that we never expected. Astronomy is about discovering new things, and telescopes are our vehicle. Now, working in concert with this forthcoming telescope is a new satellite. Now, this satellite is called the Transit Exoplanet Survey Satellite. Get this. Or TESS, or just TESS for short. And they're going to be using this in conjunction with this telescope. And they said that when these two work together, they'll use this survey satellite to detect tiny shadows of distant planets. And when they see something that looks interesting, they'll use the new telescope to then take a closer look.
I got you.
And they'll be able to really focus in. Now, they say that the Hubble telescope has given us great views of how the universe evolved when it was 2 to 5 billion years old. But this new telescope will be able to look into the past even farther than that. And that's what's so cool about these giant telescopes. Is really, when you look out farther and farther into the universe, you're actually looking back in time.
Mm-hmm.
So this thing is going to be able to look back even farther than that. I mean, that's crazy. It says that they'll be able to focus on exoplanets, get this, Cam, 500 to 1,000 light years away.
Ooh.
Planets. They'll be able to see planets 1,000 light years away.
Well, I know the Hubble telescope just recently, I think, had a 25th anniversary.
Has it really been up to space that long?
It's been launched like 20. I want to say it was just like last week was like the 25th anniversary of launching the Hubble telescope. So look at what all's changed the last 25 years. Imagine what this telescope will be able to do.
Man, it is incredible. Like I said, when you read this article, it really, really makes me want to get a telescope.
Well, can we point this now at the moon like we've talked about? Or can we point this to Mars? Can we look at these anomalous things now? Can we use this one? Now there's no excuse.
Are you waiting to see the lunar wave?
Sorry.
Have you seen all that?
Yeah, I have seen all that.
I mean, I've heard it on other podcasts, and I've seen the guy's channel on YouTube. What the heck's the guy's name? Crow777 or something like that?
Darren and Graham had him on. It was an interesting thing.
It's very interesting because it's not real.
It doesn't. I can't buy into it. I'm sorry. For all those out there that are, I can't. I personally can't. It's an interesting story, but I can't buy into it.
I believe a lot of things. The fact that the moon is a hologram, I can't. A cube is projecting this hologram. I just can't buy into that. That's a little too far.
Yeah.
Maybe 5 or 6 years of doing the show, I'll have a different mindset. I just don't think I can.
I'm all for everybody having their opinion. I think it's great. And it's an interesting story, but I can't really buy into it. Personally, I can't.
Well, Lord of the Rings is an interesting story.
Here we go again
but
with
it's
this.
It's not real.
This is what I got to put up with, folks. I'm never allowed to have that, folks. You know they're never going to point it. This is going to be another conspiracy. They're never going to point this at Mars.
Oh, yeah.
But I hope they would. I can't imagine something being that stinking powerful, though, just from mirrors and things. That's what's amazing to me. Well, I got something you're going to like. I'm going to shift gears right quick before we get into this big segment here. We all have been talking about the drones, the quadcopters and things, and we said, it'd be fun to fly them around. You know, we'd be like, that'd be fun to have.
I do want one.
Yeah, it'd be cool.
I'd probably use it just to spy on what you're doing at your house.
Yeah.
Like we've talked about before. Cam doesn't live very far from me.
Yeah, right.
What, 300 yards?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
So I'd just fly that thing over in the backyard. I thought you said you were working.
Yeah, I'm not, dude. Leave me alone. Get out of here. This actually comes from the BostonGlobe.com. You're going to enjoy this. Now, they've got them. It says, this is the drone you've been waiting for. Basically, it's from one of the minds behind the Roomba. Remember the Roomba?
Yeah, the autonomous vacuum cleaner,
yes.
Right?
basically, they say this is, you got to think of this. They call it the selfie stick with rotors. And it's a drone that, with a camera that's flown and controlled by a smartphone app.
There you go.
It's being backed by Helen Griner. Now, she's the co-founder of iRobot, who helped develop the Roomba self-driving vacuum.
So now I can periscope with a drone?
It looks like it could very easily get that way. That's probably coming. Now, of course, you know, they say that she's worked along with a few things to develop stuff for military and commercial applications, too. But this is designed to be fun and practical. And she goes on to say that this new toy is the next generation of video camera. Now, she owns the company Sci-Fi Works, but it's C-Y-P-H-Y.
Right.
In Danvers. Now, so it didn't set out to make, of course, computer drones or camera drones, basically, for the consumer. They didn't start out from making all that.
Right.
This is kind of what it's got into. Now, one of them is used for extended surveillance of large areas, and the other is a pocket drone. It's deployed for search and rescue missions. But in March of 2014, a sci-fi engineer made a chance modification, they say, to it and realized that little twist that would allow them to fly a drone level and travel it with basically little to no tilt. So it doesn't, it basically balances itself where you don't have to kind of keep working on that whole thing. They did all that. They worked. So they developed this thing and they call it the camera carrying LVL. Is what it is. Now, there's, of course, like that basically stands for level one is what it is. So they started a crowdfunder, folks. And I think that they said their initial target amount.
Oh, so they're trying to develop this.
Yeah. Well, they have it. They've got it right now. They're pledging so they can get more drones. What they're doing is they're getting that money up so they can get more drones. Now, of course, it didn't go down until early May when they first kicked it off. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the cool thing about it. It says when the level one debuted on the crowdfunding site, the fans contributed to an initial target amount of $250,000 in 3 days.
Holy cow.
And, of course, they're already pledging $495, and you'll get one of the drones.
That's awesome.
So that's what it is. Now, of course, they say that right now it's almost tripled that amount, but people already wanting to go ahead and kick in. Now, they know what they begin is they're going to start putting them out for consumer use. After February.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's going to put an end to girls sunbathing in the backyard because there'll be all kinds
forever.
Of creepers.
Exactly.
Flying over.
Now, they're going to say retail for about $600 by then.
Jeez.
Here's the thing. They said the downside is it's only got a 20-minute battery life.
Mm-hmm.
So then you're going to have to charge it and do that like that. So you and I were just talking on the last show about the little handheld drones the military has where they can throw them and fly them.
Yeah.
It seems like this is the minute I saw this, and like, folks, look, I love that. Now, it works with Android and Apple phones. They got a camera that faces down and a camera that faces forward. You can see you can bounce between those two screens on this little drone. This is the first thing that I thought of was, I can remember when this drone stuff first came out. It didn't seem but a handful of years ago. You know, honestly, to me, it didn't seem like, and it may be, of course, longer, didn't seem like it was but like 5 years ago when this stuff started getting popular.
Yeah, it was longer than that, but I know what you're saying.
But you know what I mean? And then now we're all the way up to the point of you can control it with your phone.
Yeah. Well, they didn't even have smartphones 5 years ago.
Look how fast technology has grown.
Yeah. No, no doubt.
I just hope.
I mean, I remember playing Snake on my Nokia phone, and the next thing you know, it's like I got a smartphone.
I saw where you'd taken that Nokia phone and like mounted it to a hammer handle and was using it to chip rocks.
Right?
You can't tear those things up. But yeah, so this just seems like it's one of those things that we've always talked about. It just seems to keep growing. So I don't be surprised what we're going to see in another 5 years with these drones. It's one of those things. Now you'll be able to control it with your mind.
Right.
Brain bullets.
Well, let's take a break. And when we get back from the break, we're going to get into our segment of the day. And what are we going to be talking about, Cam?
We are going to be speaking about the Bridgewater Triangle.
Right. Now, this is a subject that lots of people for months have been emailing.
Yeah.
They want us to talk about it. So we're finally doing it.
We're going to do it, folks. So I hope you enjoy it. And you're going to check that out on the other side. Thanks for listening to Expanded Perspectives.
In 1975, I moved from California to Cambridge, Massachusetts. I started picking up on this whole notion that there was an area in southeast Massachusetts that almost was a magnet of weird phenomena, and really noticed it was a triangle.
Whatever it is, we keep talking about this region for some reason.
I certainly think that the Hockomock Swamp serves as the epicenter of activity in the Bridgewater Triangle.
Off in the distance was an extremely large, man-like creature.
I saw something that I'll never forget for the rest of my life.
I saw what appeared to be the Sasquatch creature that I heard about.
Suddenly, I saw something walk. It was about 3 or 4 feet tall. It wanted to get me in its space. This is what I felt like.
A lot of people seem to think that because of King Philip's War, the Native Americans placed a curse on the Bridgewater Triangle region.
One of the greatest paranormal experiences occurred at Anawan Rock. As I turned around, I met the eyes of an older man.
The 1970s in particular were a time of very high UFO activity in the Bridgewater Triangle.
Jerry Lopes and I were heading down to the Raynham Dog Track, and all of a sudden the stars blotted out in the shape of an arrow as this thing passed overhead.
I almost felt like I could throw a rock at the thing. It seemed that close to me.
I pulled over the Raynham Dog Track parking lot. I'm right under this orb as it's birthing these ships. What I seen was definitely not from this world.
A lot of criminal cult activity happened in the Freetown State Forest.
We had evidence that rituals taking place in the state forest. Then there was a huge amount of calves with the absence of blood.
This mausoleum was broken into, and juveniles actually stole the head out of here.
They believed that they could gain power by drinking from the skull.
Legends and stories about the Bridgewater Triangle will never stop. Nobody can argue that there isn't something very special about this area.
Something real happened here. There's no other way.
That right there, my friends, is the perfect segue, I do believe, into what we're going to be talking about today. And that's right, unless you weren't paying any attention, we're going to be talking about the Bridgewater Triangle. Now,
right?
I loved it. I mean, that's the whole thing. And before we get going any further, we're going to say, you know, thank you to the man in the making of the Bridgewater Triangle documentary. That's where that little clip is like a trailer for it. If you haven't done that yet, folks, make sure to check it out. But we'll get in more of that towards the end of the show. Right now, what we're going to talk about is, of course, the Bridgewater Triangle. What's funny is we brought this up, and then Kyle and I was talking about covering it, and we brought it up on the Thursday show and all that, and we got a lot of information, feedback from a lot of the listeners that live right in the area and right around the area and drive through it and around it. And it's one of those things that's almost commonplace that people just kind of learn to live with. I mean, it's kind of like, oh yeah, Bigfoot's right over there. You just drive right by. You don't think anything of it because maybe, you know, personally, they didn't have anything happen.
And there's a lot of bizarre things that happen in this triangle. I mean, not just cryptid, but there's UFOs, there's orbs, there's phantom cats, there's phantom dogs, there's actual ghosts, there's Indian folklore and spirits,
the Puckwudge,
there's Puckwudgies, there's
the Bigfeets,
satanic rituals going on there. I mean, there's
alleged serial killer stuff that goes on through there,
and an enormous amount of unusual things seem to happen in this area of the world. And I'm always intrigued by these areas. You know, there just seems like there's certain places on Earth that are truly cursed, or there's something to them. You just get an eerie feeling. I mean, that's the number one thing people always say is you just get an eerie feeling when you're in these national forests and they're in the Hockomock Swamp and stuff.
It is. It's a strange thing. And for those of you, like I said, I had heard about this a while back, I guess, way before we ever started doing the show. I guess way whenever we were listening to different podcasts and things. And I believe it was Spooky South Coast, the podcast that actually does a lot of studies and things on it. And I had listened to several of those about it and done some reading about it. And I don't know why it never came to mind, but I said, okay, let's do this. Let's talk about this and bring some people up to speed on it. So for those of you that know everything about it, we're sorry if we're beating a dead horse. For those of you that know nothing about it, I think you're going to enjoy the heck out of this. Now, to bring everybody up to speed, of course, this area that we're talking about, the Bridgewater Triangle, is about 200 square miles of southeastern. Here we go. Me and Kyle have been working on this off air for 30 minutes of how we're going to pronounce Massachusetts.
Massachusetts.
Massachusetts. I don't know. There's so many different pronunciations. I've heard it online the whole time. So for those of you that live there, I'm sorry. Okay. I can't pronounce it. So basically, this is it. Now, it starts about 30 miles south of Boston, this 200 square mile area. And it has these towns of Abington, Freetown, and Rehoboth in it. And the way the angles work, of course, Lauren Coleman is the man that did all the work involving in it, said what he had found is it kind of makes up a triangle. Now, the reason he called it, of course, Bridgewater is the town of Bridgewater is located nearly dead center within this triangle. And then, of course, they say encompasses about six other little towns. I think it's Raham and Taunton, Brockton, Mansfield, Norton, and then Easton is the other one. Easton's always makes me think of the Arrow Company, so that's how I always remember all that whole deal. So there's several little towns in this whole area, and there's a lot of strange things like we were talking about. There's Bigfoot sightings, UFO sightings. Police officer actually had a Thunderbird sighting in there at one time. A lot of this stuff. Now, they believe the reason behind this and all this happening is what they call King Philip's War. But now, like I said, we'll get to that in a minute of what kind of led up to this whole deal. But first of all, let's talk about a few landmarks in this area. Now, Kyle just brought up the Hockomock Swamp. And the Hockomock Swamp is a 5,000-acre area in there. And like I said, in the documentary, they do a great job of filming. You see how rough and rugged this area really is, like a normal swamp. Now, it lies within basically the western section of the Bridgewater Triangle. And when you do a lot of research into it, it's basically the hub of a lot of these paranormal reports.
Yeah, it's like the heart of it.
Yeah, this is where it's, yeah, that's where this comes from. And I don't know how true it is. It's written on a bunch of things. Like I said, I haven't spoken to anybody personally that's been there, but they say that it is a Native American burial ground in that area. There's a site of one there that's an 8,000-year-old grave site. And they claim that when archaeologists actually opened up the graves of this area, that in this grassy island area, that this red ochre that was within these tombs bubbled up and then mysteriously disappeared. Wow. They also, there's claims that the photographs taken of these excavations wouldn't develop at all. And then, of course, you know, there's a lot of things that people don't want to go in there. It goes so far as the Wampanoag tribe, which is an Algonquin Nation tribe up there, they call it the place where spirits dwell, is what that they call this Hockomock Swamp. And the more things that you read about it, there is a lot of seems like you were talking about, bad and creepy feelings are picked up when people are around that swamp.
Mm-hmm. That's what it seems like.
Yeah. And there's different stories, you know, that you hear that was a staging area for some of the Native Americans during this King Philip's War and things we'll get into. But either way it is, you got to imagine it's a swamp. So it's a little bit of an eerie place to start with. And then now with all this compounded on it, I can't imagine doing any kind of research in there just from a safety standpoint alone, of snakes or anything else that might be in there. You know, it's going to be rough. You got to be careful not to get hurt, much less, you know, your adrenaline's going to be pumping, running around in there. Now, also they talk about a Dighton Rock, and this is actually on the banks of the, I guess you can call it the Taunton River, and the Dighton Rock actually lies across from this burial ground there in the Hockomock Swamp. Now, there's apparently some unknown origins of these, let's say, inscriptions of unknown origins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't know who carved them.
They have no clue, really. Now, of course, there's, like we said, they speculate. Is it Vikings? Some people, I know it's even, you and I had looked into this a while back. They were talking about it being Phoenician carving that might have been in there. People even say it's some of it's Native Americans, but they've never really been able to identify. Now, there's some strange things that they've seen and ghostly things that they've seen around this rock. Now, there's another one too, another landmark in that area that's called Profile Rock. And basically, that is what people say has gained a very paranormal reputation in that area. Now, it's actually in Freetown, and it's there's a nearby hill, and basically, it's a clear portrait, what they say, of a Native American face looking out of the stone.
That's what it looks like.
Yeah, it does. And it's strange. It's the idea that, I mean, somebody had to do some work. You know what I mean? It's if I don't know.
Do you think it was carved? I mean, I don't know if it's carved or if it's just a natural formation that happens to look like a face. I mean,
I like to believe that it was touched up. I like to believe that maybe it looked naturally and then somebody came along and touched it up.
Added to it.
Yeah. Now, I don't know. You know, I don't know it because it almost looks 100% natural. Like it's just something that your mind wants to see. I like to believe that it was touched up.
But it might have been touched up, and the patina and stuff makes it look more natural, exactly. You know, through the ages.
And how old it was, right. How old it actually could have been there. And then, of course, they say that it's actually there long before there was any colonists in the area, and that the people, the Wampanoag tribe, actually considers it a sacred rock, is what they claim. And then there's even the local legends there of Native American ghost dancers. And they all, you know, there's like a warrior dance, I believe, that they do around it. And then there's the Onawan Rock, and that's actually located in the Hockomock Swamp along Route 44 in Rehoboth. And we're going to be talking more about Route 44 later on. But this Onawan Rock is actually named for Chief Onawan, which is, they say, the site of where Chief Onawan surrendered to the colonists, ending King Philip's War. And that's where things start getting a little sketchy. That's where the whole idea of the warriors, they say, the the spirits of the fallen warriors still haunt this area, that they're still not happy. They seem that there's still a curse
right.
put on. So we're going to get into this whole King Philip's thing. Now, it took place from 1675 to 1676, and it was known as Medicone's Rebellion. But basically, it marked the last, what they said was the major effort by the natives of the southern New England area to drive out English settlers. Now, Medicone was the Pocoquet chief, and he was called King Philip by the English. And then the bands known today, of course, we talk about the Wampanoag Indians. They joined the Nipmucks and the Pocatucks, the Pocumatucks, and the Narragansetts. And anyway, they joined a big group of tribes together, and it lasted about 14 months, they say, and it destroyed 12 frontier towns. Now, we don't know how big these towns were.
Right.
Could have been small settlements. Could have been
sure.
over 100, couple hundred people. But either way, it was a big battle that wiped out a lot of things. Now, they don't really know what led up to this outbreak. Okay. They don't, as far as war, they don't really understand what started this whole thing. It's kind of unclear. But the natives, basically, they had a resentment, of course, towards the English because they had been building in that area in the 1660s, and they say that they had become increasingly dependent, let's say, on English goods and foods
right.
and you know, trading and bartering and back and forth. Well, apparently the bargaining power kind of diminished because fur trade dried up, and then they didn't have any other things to trade, things that they wanted. Of course, you know, they're like, no, get out of here, you know, and tribal lands, this, that, and was sold. And then, of course, Medicone, and there were some other leaders. They kind of wanted to be, the English wanted to put them under some sovereignty, put their thumbs on them and go, look, you know, you've been trading with us long enough. Now you're going to be one of us. We're going to tax you, you know, things the way it's going to be. You're going to play games, you know, and you're going to have to get on board. Well, they didn't really like that. And then, so the natives, of course, took up a little arms. And then, of course, I'm sure everybody wasn't doing so nice. And then, so it all kind of broke out. And then, like I said, it ended in August of 1676. And of course, they say shortly after that, Medicone, King, the one they called King Philip, was captured and actually beheaded. And the story goes that his head was stuck on a pike and kept in front of the encampment for 20 years is where that all took place. Now, of course, they say some of his supporters actually escaped and they made it off into Canada. And then the ones that, now get a load of this, this is pretty rough. The ones that were surrendered,
mm-hmm.
you know, said, okay, we'll do that. Were sold off as slaves and shipped off to the West Indies. So how terrible is that?
Yeah, right.
I mean, you go through the whole war. Not, so it's one of those things, if they had not taken the Christian faith, if they were the non-Christian, still what they considered, you know, the savages of the area, they were sold off into servitude, into slavery. And it's just it's a bad deal all the way around. So they go back into, I know there's talks about the wampum belt, and there's talks about it that was taken, I believe, and has to be brought back into the area. And there's all kinds of these stories, but it basically boils down to there's a majority of people believe it was because of a Native American curse that was put on there. Now, like you hear in the story at the beginning when Lauren's talking about all that, that he actually published the book Mysterious America in 1983. And he wrote in it, Lauren Coleman did, that there is a chapter that details everything about this triangle. And like I said, he's the man that actually dubbed it the name. And there is some strange and unusual things, like we talked about, that's happened in there. We're going to cover some of those. Now, we can get into some stuff. We'll just peruse across the top of this, of course. Like I said, 1760. In 1760, there was reports of a sphere of fire that they saw in the air over there that they said cast shadows in the morning sun. I know Halloween in 1908, there was some UFO sightings that took place in there. There was apparently some UFO sightings in 68, and in the 70s, there was several UFO sightings in the 70s in that area all the way up. And in 94, there was some police officers reported seeing a triangle shaped craft, like much of what was seen, what they believe was seen in Stephenville, that they saw that's up in this whole area. So there's tons of these different things. Even in the 70s also, too, there was some Bigfoot reports. And there's Mr. DeAndre Joseph, which is they actually interview him in the documentary and things. And he's actually known for the man that kind of kept the, I don't know if you could say the Hockomock Swamp or if you would just say the Bridgewater Triangle in general, but he really kept it up in the public view. And he kept pushing and doing a lot of research into this whole thing. Now, there are several strange things that Kyle and I have found that we've kind of picked out, you know, and we're going to discuss a few of these things. And we hope that it kind of opens your eyes to the idea that if you live around there, if you're close to that area, let's get out there and let's do a little investigation. But before we do that, let's listen to these stories right quick.
Now, there's several stories and bizarre encounters that have happened in the Bridgewater Triangle. We don't have the time to cover all of them. I mean, it would literally probably take 10 shows. I mean, there's tons of them. But we did pick out a couple cool ones, and I really liked this one. It's about the Black Dog of Abington. Now, this took place in the spring of 1976 in the town of Abington, and the whole town went into a lockdown mode when a huge, throat-eating, bulletproof dog mysteriously appeared in the rural residential area surrounded by over 100 acres of a dense swamp. Now, it says at 7 a.m. on the morning of April 30th, 1976, a sleeping Philip Kane, an Abington firefighter, was awoken by his 12-year-old daughter, Carol Kane, and she had just returned from the backyard in horror. That morning, no doubt, Carol fully expected to find her two ponies, Jojo and Peekaboo, hungry as usual and anticipating their morning feed. Instead, something was feeding on them. It was a large dog. It was enormous, and it was covered in blood. After Carol woke him up, Philip Kane grabbed a baseball bat and raced out the back door. Half awake and half dressed, Kane stumbled outside and was startled to see the two ponies. Their halters, in tangles, lying on their sides. Their throats had been ripped out. The dog was a large black and brown animal, perhaps a German Shepherd, and perhaps half Doberman, and it was hovering over the carcasses eating. The dog looked huge to Kane, perhaps the size of the pony itself. Perhaps in of its own fright, he later said, which made the animal appear as large as dead ponies. Now, the Boston Globe reported that Kane had chased the dog away, first with a baseball bat, and then, when it returned, he came back with a pistol and shot at the dog, but he missed. Now, the animal ran into the adjoining thickets and swamps. Now, over the next couple days, the police tried to track this dog down. And starting with the very next day, on May 1st, 1976, they said that was the last time the dog would be seen. Now, Abington police officer Frank Curran followed a legitimate lead to the Summer Street Railroad tracks. Now, there, Curran saw the dog slowly walking along the tracks. The animal was stained with blood. Officer Curran fired at the dog. It was a clean shot. The shot missed its large and slow target for the second time in 2 days. The last time the dog was presumed seen was last Saturday, said Frank Curran, and he fired a shot and missed. It didn't even run, Curran said when he shot. It merely turned around and walked in the other direction. Now, of course, when all this stuff was happening, panic began to spread throughout the neighborhood, and word spread fast, and fear began. Residents called the police saying they had seen the animal crossing the street at the dump. At one call said they saw it at the local ice cream stand, and one from the end of town. One man said he saw the dog. His mouth was dripping with blood in the woods behind his apartment complex. Now, over the next few days, the Abington Police Department would be deluged with over 1,000 phone calls from concerned citizens and witnesses. He reported that they had seen this large dog. Now, Abington school children were beginning to be escorted to their buses by police and armed forces. Kane became an instant expert on the dog. He was called in to look at every dog that might fit the description. In 1 week, he said, he went to Weymouth 3 times, Brockton 2 times, and Whitman 1 time. None of the dogs he was shown was the one that he had seen that day. So what do you think of that? I mean, it reminds me of the Black Shuck, those stories you hear from England.
That's the first thing I was thinking of.
Because he says it, although it looked like it was part German Shepherd, part Doberman or something, but the size of the thing. Now, he even says in his story that maybe because he was so scared, his imagination got away from him a little bit on the size of the thing. But he says that the thing looked the size of the ponies.
Well, the cool thing is that I like the fact that he actually said that himself. You know, he actually admitted, look, I was shook up. Maybe I didn't see it right, but it still was huge. It was way bigger than a normal one.
Well, and I know that there's certain listeners out there that don't believe these stories because these people are shooting at them and not hitting them. But, you know, you got to realize in a panicked moment, you just seen this, you know, could be a rabid dog. You don't know what's tearing your daughter's ponies up. You go and grab your gun. I mean, are you really going to be that steady?
Maybe not that good of a shot either.
Same thing with the police officer. He's already known that the call's been put out, and he's looking at this, and he sees it walking down the railroad tracks. He tries to take a shot. But, you know, people get buck fever. If you're not a hunter,
yeah. Well,
you
also,
can plan and practice all you want to at the range, but when the time comes, there's lots of people that miss the shot.
Well, and also it's a pistol. So it's, I mean, it's not like it's not deadly accurate at long range.
What I like is even when the police officer shot it and it didn't even run off, I mean, that to me sounds almost like a rabid dog because they're crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, they're just not there.
And it doesn't frighten them. Yeah, because I've had that happen. Like, you know, you could tell there's something wrong with like a coyote or something like that. You pop a shot at it and it don't run. That's when you're like, wait a second, what? Yeah, we've had that. That's happened. It's a really strange story. Now, this one is a little bit newer. This comes from actually from 2009. This was actually reported to the BFRO on this took place on July 14th. And this was a young fellow and his lady friend spotted what they thought was a large brown hair-covered man standing up from the crowd's position on the side of a two-lane highway. And it says, my girlfriend and I were riding in my Jeep on Route 140 from New Bedford to Freetown tonight. And at about 11 o'clock, my girlfriend saw this large brown hair-covered man standing up from a crowd's position on the side of a two-lane highway. And she lets out a scream, prompting me to look at the creature standing there. He made fluid movements like a man and had an almost ape-like quality. Now, we couldn't see his face, but upon returning to the area, we saw the man there was nothing. After calling 911 and telling them that someone is running in the median of the highway, they told us that they had similar reports of what we saw on the stretch of highway between Exit 7, which is Braley Road, and Exit 8, Chase Road. They told me that they were sending state troopers to investigate. Now, this comes from the actual investigator for the BFRO, and he goes on that says that the witness stated that they were traveling around 70 miles an hour when they passed this animal, and it was a wide midsection covered in brown body hair, darker brown, longer arms, and was approximately 7 to 8 feet tall based on the height of the highway mile marker that was just adjacent to where the animal was standing. The witness also stated that the animal had a long chiseled jaw. The total duration of the sighting was approximately 3 seconds from the time the witness turned his head and first saw the animal until his car passed the creature. As the car passed the animal, which was standing only 3 to 4 feet to the left of the hood of his Jeep, the witness reported having a scared sensation and noted that the animal had one arm down and the other arm up in a bent position as if getting ready to cross the northbound lane. The witness exited the highway approximately 2 miles north of the sighting and traveled back southbound to the point of the sighting, but didn't see anything unusual. Although the placement of the 911 call by the witness was not confirmed, the witness reported that he subsequently had an informal discussion of the sighting with a friend who was a Massachusetts state trooper who was on call that night. The police officer told him that the local dispatcher did receive several related calls around the same time that evening, and that he and several of the troopers responded to the call and arrested several teenagers who were in the area. However, upon receiving this information, the witness remained steadfast in his belief that what he saw was not a teenager playing a prank. And the location of this sighting is immediately west of the Bolton Cedar Swamp and recognized as an important conservation land tract comprised of wetlands, ponds, bogs, and acidic swamps vegetated with Atlantic white cedar, pitch pine, and scrub oak.
Man, that's crazy, right?
Well, it makes sense. I mean, this is what I like is, okay, he says he passed it, okay?
Yeah, and lots of people have these same similar sightings.
Yes. And the first thing I thought is, okay, it's 11 o'clock. It's in the nighttime. You know, you're what are you really seeing? And then he said, all right, they're doing 70, all right? They're hauling ass. They're in a Jeep. More than likely the top's down. It's July, okay?
Right.
There's probably been a drink or two. I'm not going to lie. You know, they probably had a few drinks.
Yeah, but it was 3 feet away.
But that's what I'm getting. It's 3 or 4 feet away. I mean, it's not. Look, I've driven right by things in the middle of the night when you're on the deer leash. You're just driving and you run by and you're like, well, right there was a possum on the side of the road.
Yeah,
you're
can still identify things.
Cleanly. I mean, you can see it because it's within arm's reach. The scared feeling he had, I can't imagine, because you're talking about something. You could tell how massive it is at 3 or 4 feet. You're not going to mistake that for a teenager playing a prank at right? 3 or 4 feet.
And even the statey said that he had been other calls that night.
Yes.
And that they had arrested a few teenagers and things. But, you know, the guy was like, it was definitely not a teenager playing a prank.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting story, man. I love that. there were some other Bigfoot encounters that I thought were pretty cool that were played during the documentary. Let's listen to one of those.
In addition to Joseph DeAndrade, deceased West Bridgewater resident John Baker reported his own Bigfoot sighting while fur trapping in the Hockomock Swamp in the early 1980s. A Boston Herald article featured an interview with Baker concerning his encounter.
Something was following me, and I knew it was big. So I took the boat down a small creek to a dry hill, and it kept moving. I knew it wasn't a human because when it passed by me, I could smell it. It smelled like skunk, musty and dirty, like it lived in the dirt. To this day, I don't know what it was, but I know I saw it, and it was out there.
Very interesting. Reminds me a lot of the skunk apes that are seen in Florida.
Yes.
We talked about the smell and the smell of dirt and the griminess of it.
Mm-hmm.
And very interesting. Now, you know how we are big fans of fae folk. And one of the cool sightings one of the coolest I've ever heard of that has taken place there in the Bridgewater Triangle are the sightings of puckwudgies.
Yes.
Now, we make jokes around here because my littlest son, Luke, he's only 3, and I always call him a puckwudgie. But puckwudgies, I mean, it's a Native American word for, you know, like these little people, these fae folk and stuff. And one of the guys in the documentary has a really interesting encounter with one of these things. Let's listen to that.
Perhaps the most intriguing yet lesser known report of a cryptic animal sighting in the Hockomock Swamp occurred in 1990. Former Raynham resident William Russo will never forget his amazing up-close and personal encounter.
Back in the late 1980s to about the mid-1990s, I was working a 3-to-midnight shift in the town of Raynham where I lived. And that's where my strange happening occurred. When I got off work every night at midnight, I'd walk my dog Samantha. She was a Rottweiler Shepherd mix, big, around 90 pounds. Now, usually we walked on the sidewalks towards the center of town. But on this particular night, we walked a different route. I don't really know why, but we did. Right behind my house is an area we called the High Tees, claimed by the electric company. They run those high-tension wires. It's about 50 feet across and overgrown with 100-foot pines. So it's kind of like a route for kids who want to take shortcuts and who knows what kind of wildlife during the day and at night, maybe stranger things. I went perhaps a half a mile when I came to an old water wheel that ran an early ironworks back a couple of hundred years ago. And there's a street light at this road, and the street light casts a big circle of light right in the middle of the street, about a 10-foot radius. So as I approached the road, all of a sudden Sammy, my dog, started to pull at the leash, and I looked down and she was quivering, she was shaking, she was rattling like an old Chevy. And then a few moments later, I heard what was scaring the dog. It was a high-pitched, almost a wail, and it went like this. It went, "He wants you. He wants you. Here. Here. He wants you." Now the hairs on the back of my neck started to go up, and Sammy, of course, she was just absolutely in terror. And suddenly I saw something walk. It was erect, standing straight up. It walked into the middle of that circle of light that was cast by the street lamp. It was about 3 or 4 feet tall. It had a pot belly. And as I walked a little closer, I saw that it wasn't clothed. It had hair that was maybe 3-4 inches long, totally covered in hair. It had eyes that were perhaps a little big for its head, but not hugely disproportionate. The face perhaps looked like the chipmunk. At first, I thought it was a child. But as I analyzed it, I thought it was in the beginning stages of old age. I don't think it was young. Whatever it wasn't young. But it was speaking. I mean, it definitely speaking, and it kept saying, "He wants you. He wants you." Got more insistent, and it started beckoning me. "Here. Here. He wants you." It wasn't threatening me, but what was weird, it wasn't advancing to me. It didn't come near me. It wanted to get me in its space. This is what I felt like. I wish I could say that I was brave enough to go right up and, you know, get that close from it, but I couldn't. I was scared. And my Sammy, Samantha, was scared, so we turned around and we walked home pretty fast. And I stayed up the whole night analyzing, what could this be? What could this be? And here's what I think it was saying. My best guess is, E want you is, we want you. We want you. Here, here, come here, come here. I think it was speaking English. I rarely told anyone about it. I didn't know at the time the stories about the Bridgewater Triangle. I've never seen anything paranormal. I just didn't feel like sharing the story. But, you know, that was almost 20 years ago. And I'm getting up in age, and I felt I should pass it along. So I wrote a little internet blog on it, and I want to share it. I want people to know about it. I went back many times and never again saw it.
What an incredible encounter. I love the stories of the Fae folk, and I like the fact that it's talking to him.
It's trying to converse.
How many times have we heard that, that these Fae folk are tricksters, they try to lure you into the woods?
What I thought about whenever I first heard that story was this, is the Native American language. You know, remember I did a segment about the Bigfoot that was speaking what they thought was old Native American languages.
Uh-huh.
It makes me think of that. Is the Pukwudgie, are they so used to the old Native American languages in that area that that's what, and that's like a broken English. He's trying to speak English to the guy. You know, he's trying to get the dude to fall for it.
I know. And I love the stories where they like try to lure you into the woods.
Yeah. You're like, I mean, it's fine. Come on. Come with us. It's cool.
Right? It's so scary. Creepy.
I don't. Yeah, it is. It is because, look, you're probably not going to go with a little creepy troll looking thing, but how many people get tricked by the pretty fairies with the wings and whatnot? You
right?
know, how many people that vanished were like, you know, it's, I love the Fae folk stories. I can't help it. Especially those like that. The Pukwudge. I mean, he's obviously he was up to no good.
Yeah.
The minute he talks about the light and all that stuff, I'm like, can you imagine even seeing? First of all, I'm like, why are you walking your dog at midnight, bro? What's the matter with you, man?
That you dog know, can't maybe wait. He couldn't sleep or something, you know.
Well, he said he got home, you know, from work, but still, I mean, like, man, I don't know if I could get out there and walk my dog at
midnight. He walked a different path than he normally takes, too, but he doesn't take that one anymore.
Oh, I bet he don't, yeah. I bet he ties that dog to a treadmill. He's like, hey, we're just going to walk in the house today. No Pukwudge going on. Well, I got you something a little creepier, too. This is something, when I told you I was going to get back into the Route 44 thing, folks, is this is one of my favorite things that I've found, and it's really kind of a creepy thing, and it's the redheaded hitchhiker of Route 44. Now, you've got to imagine this, man. You've got to imagine a very, like a homeless look, a very disheveled, like a messy beard, pretty much like what I'm wearing now, a very messy red beard. They said a red plaid shirt, kind of, you know, messy hair. Basically kind of like a homeless hitchhiker guy that you would picture in your mind that you would probably never want to pull over and pick up. Now, there's a fella named Charles Turek Robinson, and he actually wrote a book and had it published in 1994. And people are, you know, this is a great book, and it's The New England Ghost Files, an authentic compendium of frightening phantoms. And he actually called the hitchhiker the redheaded phantom of Route 44, and he labeled it. Now, there's several little stories out of that book. And it comes from Rehoboth, you know, that's where he's from. Now, there's several little stories out of that book, and I'm going to read you just a couple of these things, these really creepy tales that I think you're going to enjoy. The first one comes about a couple from Swansea, and he calls the couple Harry and Shanae Hansen. Now, he says, Harry and Shanae were driving Route 44 in October of 1984 when the car broke down, and Harry told Shanae to stay in the car while he tried to find a payphone to call AAA Road Service. And for all you youngsters listening that don't know what a payphone is, yes, there used to be a telephone that you could put quarters in and use on the side of the road by most convenience stores and gas stations. Now, the man makes his way down the dark road, and when he spots what he describes as a sloppy-looking guy with red messy hair sitting on the side of the road, the man asked the stranger if he knew where the closest payphone was. The stranger didn't answer. The man asked again. The messy red-haired man only sat in silence, staring at him. So the man asked again and again, and there was more silence. One more time, the man asked, and now he notices what he describes as an odd grin upon the stranger's face. The man asked the stranger if he's okay. Upon posing the question, the stranger's face changed. The man described the eerie nighttime encounter with the hitchhiker this way. Suddenly, the man's face got very strange. He stopped grinning. He twisted his mouth, and I noticed that there was something wrong with his eyes. They were all clouded over. No pupils or anything, just blank and all white. I began to feel weird and started to walk away from him. And as I hurried away, I heard the man laughing. I turned around, but he was no longer there. I mean, I could no longer see him there, but I still heard the laughing. It was coming from just a few feet away from me, and the laughing kept switching locations, first in front of me, then behind me, then to the left. It was bizarre. The man ran back to the car in fright, only to find his wife standing outside of it, visibly terrified. She tells her husband that after he left, she had turned on the car radio and was listening to a song, when to her horror, suddenly the song wasn't coming out of the radio anymore. A very creepy man's voice came out of the car speakers instead. The voice taunted her and called her by name, all the while laughing hysterically.
What?
Right? So it took over the radio.
How is that?
I don't know. I don't want to know.
Right? That's creepy.
I'm going to give you another one right here from 1973. A man named Fred. Now it says, one summer night at around 10 o'clock, Fred saw the hitchhiker and Fred pulled over to give him a lift and saw the man running towards his truck in the rearview mirror. Now the man climbed in and Fred asked him where he was headed. The man just sat there in silence, smiling. And again, Fred asked, well, where are you going? The man just sat there in the cab of the truck, smiling. And that was enough for Fred. He pulled the truck over and ordered the man out, and the hitchhiker complied. But instead of opening the truck door, he simply disappeared. He just stared. It started to get real hazy until I couldn't see him anymore. He just vanished. Now, what is that?
It's like a specter.
A fading away of it, right?
It's like the ghost of a hitchhiker or something, right?
Yes. Now, here's the last one I'm going to tell you about the redheaded hitchhiker right quick. And this is another one here that comes from the book that old Charles wrote. Now, you're going to like this one. This is where he calls the man Joe. Now, this is the witness here. And he says, Joe reported that, I saw a man's face outside the car pressed against the passenger side window. This was physically impossible. My car was traveling about 50 miles an hour. The face was looking at me, grinning. I could see that the man had red hair and was wearing a red plaid shirt. I swerved off the highway and brought my car to a stop. But at that time, the man had vanished. After about 10 minutes, I finally calmed down enough to restart my car and drive home. The incident has left me shaken up for the past 25 years. He says this encounter actually took place in 1969.
Oh.
So it's one of those things. What is this? I mean, because those are three different tales and all three different things happened. First of all, a man encountered him.
Right.
And the thing started laughing and vanished. And then it came through the radio talking to his wife. The second one was the dude actually physically picked him up. Somehow, whatever it was, opened the door, got in the truck, closed the door.
Yeah.
Then vanished. And now this thing is, it's like a spectral, like you said, it's something that's stuck to the outside of his car, messing with him. That's three different things, but all of them look exactly the same. They all report seeing the same guy, but it's capable of doing three different things. Now, what is that?
Man, I have no idea. And their stories aren't from just the 70s and the 60s and stuff. There are current stories being, mm-hmm. and if you go to the Bridgewater Triangle documentary.com, you can click on a tab up there called Your Stories, and there's a whole bunch of recent stories. Now, much like we talked about earlier with all the strange occurrences happening in the Bridgewater Triangle, one of the eerie things that's going on there is Satan worship.
Mm-hmm.
There's apparently a small cult or something that's been worshiping there for years. They've found all kinds of animal sacrifices. They've even found people where they've broken into a mausoleum and would steal the cadavers and stuff that were in there to be used in these ceremonies. Now, one of the experiences on this website is pretty new, and this was submitted on, let's see, February 20th of 2014.
Nice.
And it says, it's funny. I guess I grew up right in the Bridgewater Triangle, and I never knew it. I never knew it was a thing before till last night. That being said, I always felt like the area was a little off, especially in the woods. Now, in the woods between my home in Brockton and the neighboring town of Abington, where I worked delivering pizzas. I've long since grown up and moved halfway around the world, but I thought I'd drop a line and share one of these weird things
and it's one of the strangest things I ever saw while living in the Triangle. Now, back in the mid-90s, me and a friend of mine were poking around off-trail in the Ams Knoll State Park, looking for an out-of-the-way place to dig some jumps for our dirt bikes, when we came up on a makeshift altar made out of a carved-up tree stump, and on the altar was a mirror splattered with blood, a small pile of what looked like chicken bones, and a dead dog ripped open from throat to tail with a railroad spike driven through its head. I can't really do any justice by what's running through our heads at that moment, but I had this really weird feeling of being watched, and the trees pressing in a lot closer and darker than they had felt before we had stopped and jumped off our dirt bikes. We got back on those bikes and we throttled out of there as fast as we could. We never called the police or told anyone because we figured that being a couple of rebellious teenagers, we'd probably get blamed for killing the dog, and we'd catch heat for being out there digging illegal dirt bike trails. Either way, we didn't need the static. Almost 20 years later, that experience still sticks with me as one of the creepiest things I have ever seen. And from that moment on, I was always a little edgy about slowing down for stop signs when my deliveries took me past that part of town. Right? I don't know what it is, but when you see that sacrifice, a sacrificial altar and stuff like that, it is scary.
Something
it is
about
creepy,
it. Yeah.
Right? I mean,
yeah.
I don't know. Something about that, those kind of stories always creep me out.
Well, I've got one here before we wrap this little dumpling up. The reason I found it is it's the same thing. It's a recent story, but it made me think of the last episode we did about the Hat Man. All right? Now I want you to listen to this.
Cool.
This comes from, this was the same thing. It's Jessica submitted this. Now, this comes took place December 16th of 2014. It says, my husband and I bought our home in West Bridgewater a year and a half ago, and we have recently experienced a sighting in our home. I have had small instances where lights have been turned on that are not even plugged in and cabinets being opened, but I didn't think much of it at the time. A few nights ago, I woke up in the middle of the night and I saw a shadow man standing at the end of my bed. I'd never seen anything like it before, and I woke my husband up to look, and the shadow had disappeared. I felt scared and crazy that he couldn't see what I had just saw. I haven't seen the shadow since, but I'm interested in looking into the previous owners of the home and the history of the house. So she's had a shadow man experience, but what she just, when she reported this, it had only happened a few days ago. So she's not reported anything else to this website, but still it could have been, I wonder where, if this escalated, if it took place of anything else, because that's another thing that I was wondering when I, even when I found that story was after we had talked about the Hat Man, and then, and this got me to thinking, I wonder how many other people, residents, have had strange things happen in their homes that live in that area that haven't really been discussed.
Yeah.
Because everything we've talked about has taken place in the woods or in that area traveling, not in the homes. I wonder how many people have had, maybe there's a lot of Hat Man, you know, encounters or Shadow Man encounters in this area too. Maybe it infects everything.
Well, there's lots of other things, like I said, that we're not going to be able to get into. So I'm sure some people are like, oh, you didn't tell this story. Or, yeah, you didn't tell the best part. There's hundreds of stories. And like we talked about, you know, in this, on this show and other, there's been other sightings, you know, like giant cats, giant snakes,
yep,
the size of stovepipes. Like you said, Indava birds and there's giant thunderbirds, UFOs,
so much, yes,
flying orbs. Much reminds me of the Brown Mountain Lights or the Marfa Lights. There's been things like that seen, spirits.
I've read, there's articles on here too where people are talking about seeing like headless bodies walking across streets in front of people and walking off into the grasses. And people, I mean, this is something that there is high strangeness, heavy
murders
in this area.
People have been murdered. They found murdered bodies tied to trees and things. There's been alien abductions. It's just, the list goes on and,
yeah,
on. It is a bizarre area. And I wonder if it all stems from that war that we talked about. And it's really just like the area is cursed.
Or I wonder that, or I also wonder this. What if the war stemmed from that area being cursed?
Could be.
What if that was something that was already bad to start with and it just played on everybody's emotions?
Could be.
Yeah, that's kind of what I don't know. There's a lot of stuff, folks. There's tons of books. There's tons. Check out the documentary. There's tons of stuff to check out about the Bridgewater Triangle. Thanks for sticking around with us. We're going to take a quick break. We hope you enjoyed it. And you're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Yeah.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Hope everybody enjoyed that. It's pretty cool, man. The Bridgewater Triangle, I mean, it is ginormous, the amount of sightings and strange stories that come from that area. You know, we can't talk about all of them. And I'm sure over the next couple of months, we'll probably do stories from that area.
We should,
I mean,
yeah.
There's just hundreds and hundreds. I mean, from orbs to UFOs to
that date
giant
back a
snakes.
Long time.
Yeah, I mean, it's really pretty interesting. I wonder, I don't know. It's pretty cool.
I love it. I love the fact of it. It's one of those things. We're going to have to take a trip. We're going to have to go up there. Now, I know there's a podcast, Spooky South Coast. Those mm-hmm. guys do it a lot of it. They cover a whole lot of it. I think they actually go out and do some research on it often.
We're on Dark Matter Radio with them. They're
okay,
on there
cool.
too.
So yeah, folks, check them out. I think they actually have some episodes that are just on them talking about the stuff that goes, I mean, like in the field, live people in the field calling in and doing it. So that may be something we may have to go check out in the whole deal. And I also like the documentary, folks.
Yes, yes. Everybody needs to go over there and get that documentary.
Check it,
man.
Out.
It's amazing.
You could go to the Bridgewater Triangle Documentary.com. That's what it is. And Aaron Cadeau. That's it. But he's from Dartmouth. I think it's where he's from. He's not from Louisiana. So, I mean, that sounds like a Louisiana last name.
It does, right?
Right?
French.
Yeah. So, anyway, folks, he's the director of the show. It's great. You know, Lauren was in. There's a bunch of folks in it. But it's the Bridgewater Triangle Documentary.com. And I loved it. I really liked that whole documentary. Yeah,
I did, too.
That was fun.
Some neat accounts on there. It's pretty cool. And I got some promo codes here
right
if
on.
You do want to watch it. Now, if you want to get $2 off on a Blu-ray, just put in the promo code BTEPB, and the same thing for a DVD code. And if you want to watch it on demand, you want to stream it, you can get $1 off on Vimeo, and that promo code is BTEPV. So try those out. You can get a discounted price on the viewing of this documentary. It's
and
pretty cool.
Somebody else I want to thank, too. Miss Kristen Good, now you can go to her website, which is thebridgewatertriangle.com, and it's a big blog site that's titled Beyond the Bridgewater Triangle, and she has done an amazing job of filling in pretty much everything from years back all the way up till now. She's got links to videos, she's got all of her blogs where she writes about all the stories. You can follow her on Facebook. She's even been, I know, on Spooky South Coast. You can go on there and listen to her on there. She covers everything. She goes like back to the basics to what started it all, the sightings, the things that are all the way up to some of the most popular stuff. And like I said, then she's got YouTube videos on there. It's got everything. And then if you've got any questions or whatever, you can even email her. But here's what you do. If you just want to check it out, go to the BridgewaterTriangle.com website. And that's her blog site where you can go and read about all kinds of stuff.
Pretty cool. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening today. Don't forget, if you have some interesting stories or news that you would like to share with the show, you can go to expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can always visit the website, expandedperspectives.com, or you can even call the show and leave a voicemail and tell us your story or why you just like listening to Expanded Perspectives, and you might hear yourself play during one of our breaks. That number is 817-945-3828. So, everybody, have a good week. For you elitists, we'll be speaking to you on Thursday. Cam, do you have any idea what you're going to be speaking about on Thursday?
I'm probably going to do a few more stories out of the Bridgewater Triangle.
Right on.
And then I think I'm going to do some stuff over the Bennington Triangle next.
The Bennington Triangle. What is that?
Yes, that's just, if I gave it away right now, but yeah, basically it's up near Vermont is where it's at. So it'll be like a little Vermont triangular area there that's had like some missing people in it and some strange occurrences that go right around in this area too. So we're going to be talking about that.
Awesome. Awesome. Everybody have a good week. Peace.